Hello and welcome to the Fellowship Phase, an Adventures in Middle-earth podcast. I'm Josh and that's Callum. We're going to give you inside information on how to find your own path through Tolkien's world.
Bilbo had a corslet of Mithril rings that Thorin gave him. I wonder what has become of it. Gathering dust still in Mikul Delving's Mavum house, I suppose.
What?
Cried Gimli, startled out of his silence.
A corslet of Moria silver? That was a kingly gift.
Yes, said Gandalf. I never told him, but its worth was greater than the value of the whole Shire and everything in it.
Hello, Callum, and Gimli and Gandalf, apparently.
Hello!
I love it. What are we talking about today? What's that introduction leading us to talk about?
Goals!
Money, 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 money! Indeed, yes. We're talking about money, economy in role-playing in Tolkien's world. And why are we talking about this?
We're talking about this because I think it is a bit tricky in Adventures Middle-earth and Lord of the Rings role-playing game compared to Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes, it is. And we've had quite a lot of experience with that. And I think we never really thought about why it's tricky, other than that we didn't kind of gel with the rules and slightly did away with them. And then we were talking earlier on, and I said I couldn't really remember examples of money being mentioned in Middle-earth. And this triggered us to think, is it mentioned in Middle-earth? No, it is. And a lot has been written about this. We've done a bit of research. I was looking at a thing here from Robert Foster's The Complete Guide to Middle-earth. It talks about money. And he says in it that contrary to the claims of Sun, there are references to money, kind of implying that back in the day, people thought that there was no money in Tolkien. It wasn't really mentioned. And actually, it appears quite a lot. I think it's interesting that I had completely forgotten. It's obviously quite a forgettable part of the story that there's money. There's obviously treasure, and that makes a big part of it. But I was really struggling to think of examples when, particularly the heroes in Tolkien, ever used money or sought it out. Like, it was never really a motivation or anything like that. So we wanted to dig into it and figure out if the reason that money didn't work in our game is that money is actually not really an important part of Middle-earth, or if there's something else.
We're just messed it up. Yeah, I think maybe what should we start with? Should we start with the lore or should we start with the game?
Let's start with the lore, because I think that helps us then build into what we would want out of the game.
That makes sense. Well, the Tolkien Gateway, which is a very useful resource if you're a lore master and you're looking to get some research done quickly. So it summarizes where money is mentioned. So there's a couple of points. So Azog, the great goblin orc, who in the book dies at the Battle of Azumblar, or apologies for that, threw a money purse at Nar containing a few coins of little worth. Bilbo rushes out from his house to meet Thorin and the party of dwarfs, and he says he travels without a walking stick or any money that he usually took with him when he went out, so obviously hobbits use money.
That's interesting, just on that one before we keep it, that's interesting that very quickly in The Hobbit, Tolkien establishes that whilst money is a thing, Bilbo does not have any and therefore won't be using any. It's almost like he's like, yeah, money's a thing, but we're not gonna talk about that.
Money's gone. After the death of Smaug, and the destruction of Lake Town, we'll never know why it's called that, the people were angry at the master of aforementioned Lake Town and declared, "We've had enough of the old men and the money counters." And others took up the cry of up with the bowmen and down with the money bags.
That was the first example when we talked before we recorded of thinking of men using or talking about money. The other examples we'd come up with were shadowy things, evil things that used gold and money.
Once after Smaug's defeated and Bilbo goes home, he takes home two chests of gold. Oh no, two chests, one of gold and one of silver. and as a result is considered rich in addition to his existing wealth. And he dealt in, so obviously the hobbits of Bree and the Shire deal in coin money. And going back to Bree, so Bree is mentioned there as well. So there's a mention that a pony is considered to be worth about 4 silver pennies. And Barlaam and Butterbur, the patron of the prancing pony at the time of Lord of the Rings, considers a loss of 30 silver pennies to be a considerable blow. And I think there's a couple of other small references, and there's some lore about like the names of coins and where money is mentioned. That's some of the most key ones. And some takeaways from that is that, you know, obviously silver coins, so 4 silver coins per pony. You know, I think in normal D&D you might think that 4 silver coins isn't that much, because we're used to the extravagant, you know, massive heroic moments with lots and lots of gold, like 1,000 gold pieces for something.
Yeah.
And in Lord of the Rings, that would be a ludicrous amount of money.
Yes, it doesn't really translate, which I think is part of the problem we had, was the game translates across. The rules, certainly Adventures of Middle-earth from 5th edition. And I think we probably didn't separate in our heads which rules we were keeping and which rules we were dispensing with. And we thought, yeah, money, we'll translate that across. And it just didn't really work. Something I think it's interesting is that Tolkien was obviously so thorough in the preparation of the world, particularly and most famously around language and the languages, and that was obviously his great passion, but also in the history. You look at Silmarillion and the just the sheer depth of history that the world has. From an economic point of view, it's kind of sort of hand-waved. That's not really part of the history. And there's a lot of talk of trade and of different cultures being focused and wealthy because of trade. So the dwarves are very linked to kind of gold and mining and producing things. Whereas the Shire, it's kind of implied that that's this more pastoral thing where they don't really use coin other than maybe getting beer at the Green Dragon. It's interesting, I think, the fact that Tolkien spent so much less time on currency, money, and economics compared to the other parts of the lore, which he went into huge depth about. I think probably shows how little he felt that was important in the fantasy world.
Which is interesting, I think. You know, it's the sort of story that he's wanting to tell. Like, as just as in, you know, in a game, we talk about, you know, rewarding the players for the game you want them to play. Yeah. You know, if you're creating a story, you don't have to write about everything. If you're creating a world, you don't have to spell everything out. You know, it just wasn't of interest to him, and that's fine. But then it does mean that if you're playing a role-playing game in that setting, you know, should that be part of the game?
Yeah.
You know, if it was so unimportant to him to spend so little time spelling it out, like, obviously there are some mentions of it and it does exist, but really it doesn't tie with the themes. And the main themes that come about to do with money are negative. It's a thing associated with the shadow, with the control. So Josh, you were giving an example earlier on before we started recording.
Yeah, of Smaug, who's the main villain in The Hobbit. At least there are probably, you could identify other, but he's probably the main villain. The story is structured around defeating him. The mission they go on is to go and reclaim treasure. Now, his motivation, his agenda is the accumulation of wealth. And he doesn't use it for anything. He has a hall filled with treasures. And one of the reasons that the heroes kind of begrudge him of that is that he has these precious artifacts, these things with heirloom meaning. He does nothing with. He just simply lies on top of all of it. And that feels quite a clear message that the accumulation just of gold is not a good thing. That is an evil agenda. And actually, near the end of the Hobbit, I think it's Thorin says to Bilbo that if more people cared about, you know, cheer and song and good food and less about gold, the world would be a better place. Which is, it feels that was kind of the quote where Tolkien was speaking very directly about his view of the world, about the things that are important, you know, language and friendship and food and song. And then gold was not part of that. And the examples of treasure in the book are often very practical. So the first ones I was thinking, you know, in The Hobbit, a lot of the treasures are weapons. The same is true in Lord of the Rings, that they're things that you find, and it's talked about that they're maybe from a previous age, they're elven, they're maybe valuable beyond measure. But they have a practical purpose, and they kind of represent being heroic, and they're used to defeat the shadow. It's not just money. What we've not really thought about, though, which I don't know which side this fits in, is ultimately both books are centered on the ring, which is the main treasure. It doesn't really have a monetary value. That's not what I mean. It's obviously gold, and the other rings are described as being, you know, bejeweled and decadent kind of artifacts. But where does that fall into it? Is it the fact that the importance of the ring, that treasure, has nothing to do with money and is all about power? And that's what the book is about?
I think it's tied up a little bit because, you know, it's made of gold. And when Sméagol and Dégol are fighting over the ring, the line is, he caught Dégol by the throat and strangled him because the gold looks so bright and beautiful. Yes. That allure of gold, of wealth. And, you know, I think gold can be beautiful, but it's tied up in a monetary value as well. You know, what can you do with gold? Although maybe not, I guess, because, you know, some things that are precious are there because they're aesthetically pleasing rather than actually what you're going to do with them.
Which I suppose that's kind of the way we see with elves and their perhaps their art and their artifacts are things of beauty for the sake of being beautiful. So they the elvish culture is implied as being not wealthy, but when it's described, it feels wealthy and with riches compared to the Shire, which is a simpler life. But just for the sake of its beauty, not because the elves want money. The dwarves are probably the closest to what we would think of as kind of like modern world capitalism, money, trade, precious resources. But even then, they're not driven by the accumulation of.
Yeah, we talk about dragon sickness, and that's, you know, you know, the madness that comes from, you know, gold that's been sat on by a dragon, and the way in which that can change someone to becoming greedy. And that's reflected in the game, in the shadow sickness rules in Adventures of Middle-earth. So one of them is dragon sickness for the treasure the hunter.
Treasure hunter. Burglar. Come on. I actually wanted to talk about burglars in a second, but yes, sorry, you're saying about dragons.
So, you know, there's a whole thing wrapped up in the game about this spectrum between, you know, a minor requirement for gold to get by all the way up to like dragon sickness and, you know, being corrupted by that greed and need for gold, for gold's sake. And I think it's very clear that that was viewed as a negative aspect.
Yes.
Now, I wonder if we now switch into talking about the game rules?
Yeah. Now, I think this is where the two things, gamifying anything, role play, like distilling any kind of situation into role play, there are always these points which are difficult, because it's difficult to take an abstract thing or tone and make rules. And we know that rules are important as part of the sort of shared experience, because they help us all play together. I think part of the problem is the way that money kind of entered the world and became a thing was that people obviously used to just trade directly. Would trade whatever resource they had for another resource. As that became more complicated, there needed to be a kind of standardized way of doing that.
Yeah.
Because it became less and less clear what the value of things were, and it was, you know, things were very difficult to trade.
Also, it's practically difficult to go out shopping and take, like, you know, a big pile of sheep with you. Be like, buy a carrot for a quarter of a sheep.
Standardized trade, which makes sense. And obviously the development of money since then into, you know, 21st century money is incredibly complicated. But on the simplest terms, it's standardized trade. And that's actually something we do need in the game, because although we know about Tolkien's world, we're not very experienced on knowing what the value of a pony is versus what the value of a night's stay at an inn is. Like those, we almost need money at the rule to say, oh, this is how much this is worth in comparison to that. Because the rules of the game, it's very much about resource management, you know, opportunity cost. If we're going to do this thing, what does that mean we're not doing? If you don't have rules of how the money works, if you can't say this thing has value and this thing has value, therefore you have to choose, it's quite difficult. But that's kind of antithetical to what Tolkien's work is about. So it's you kind of have to shoehorn in this rule to allow players to be to stay at an inn, or to pay a toll to cross something, or to acquire new equipment. But if you're not an expert on the value of all these things, how do you
figure out? How do you, Loremaster, make sure you don't break the economy? Spoilers, that's what I did. So I wonder if now I can just lay out the basics of how it works, both in Adventures of Middle-earth and in Lord of the Rings role-playing game.
Yes.
Because I think actually the newer rules are much better here. And part of the reason why I think it didn't work, so, you know, when we learn from doing things, I think one of the best times to learn is from your mistakes. And I definitely think that if I was to go back in time, I would have run money differently. So in the Adventures of Middle-earth game, there's a section in equipment, page 146 of the player's handbook, and it lays out silver and gold, and it talks about, you know, that one's set in Wilderland around Dale and the Mirkwood Forest. Barter was a rule, small settlements traded their labour, as Josh talked about, but then coins came into circulation with the re-emergence of Dale and Erebor. There's commerce's return, there's newly minted coins. So it's becoming, you know, they're tying it back into the theme, which is nice to say that, you know, actually money's becoming an important part. And actually in our game, I've made sort of plot points about where coins have been minted. And when you find coins that have been minted somewhere suspicious, that actually can be quite useful. So they talk about there's three coins values. There's copper, silver, and gold. And I find this really confusing. So let's start at the bottom because that makes the most sense to me. So you've got 12 copper coins equals one silver penny. Immediately confusing. It's not decimal. Like it kind of makes
sense. It's a weird imperial sort of thing, but
And then, okay, so you've got a silver penny is 12 copper coins. How many silver pennies are in a gold? 20. Why? One gold is 340 copper coins. And immediately headaches. Like the number of times we were having discussion is like, well, how many silver and copper? And like, oh God. And then it just became too complicated and we'd give up. Because it was never fun. I don't think it's ever fun to be like, how many, you know, it doesn't feel like you're in character if you're struggling to work out the most basic math about, you know, values of things. Because these characters that you're playing, they should know.
Yeah, they would. Yes, they would just know.
There's some sections about barter, trade, and gifts. So, you know, where trades and gifts could sometimes be useful in changing how audience interact, which I quite like. There's talk about how things might have different values in different places. So, you know, things are in rare supply. So if you're in Rohan, you know, horses are obviously very valuable, but there's a lot more of them around. In other places of the world, there might be much fewer horses, so maybe they're even more expensive. And then there's sections about standards of living. So they talk about like, well, where does the money go? So rather than saying like you have to pay for every single individual item, they just talk about each background has got a standard of living, and then each standard of living has a set amount of costs per year.
Yeah.
So though as a say rich background character, standard of living, you get more starting equipment and better starting equipment often. Your living costs for a year are 24 gold per year, whereas if it's from a poor background, it's one. So it's actually kind of trying to say that you should be spending more money to keep up that lifestyle. And so maybe money is more of a motivation for those characters.
Which is interesting because that means it's very structured that at the end of the year or what however you're planning at the end of the season, you need to kind of flat rate pay an amount of money. That then does rather imply that you need to drive the players towards accumulating money. And I don't think much of the rest of the game is actually about that.
And I'm also not sure that's fun. Right? Oh, I had a fun game. Let's do the fellowship case. What do you do? Pay up.
Yeah, settle up your bills. Because very few quests are the quest givers offering you money. Now, in other role-playing games, a more kind of generic or high fantasy setting, it might be that it's like, oh, you know, you go see the wizard and they're willing to give you X amount of gold if you deal with this problem. And actually, if you hark back to first edition of D&D, XP and gold were actually the same thing. The way you accumulated XP to level up was by accumulating gold. I think a single gold piece was a single experience point. And that was effectively the reward you gave players. You delve into a dungeon, you get the treasure, you get this amount of coin, therefore you level up. And you would be very driven. As we've talked about this before, like you reward the players for the type of game you want. So you want them to delve into a dungeon? Great. Then they can level up by getting what's in the dungeon. But that's not really what our game's like. And I don't think, I mean, in the adventure books that you've got, they've obviously got some quests for you to run as a lore master. Does it ever give you a monetary reward? Like, does it say, you know, if the players take this quest, then give them this much money?
Yeah, often in the Prudes and Adventures, as a side thing, there's treasure, and there's a whole set of things called treasure rules or treasure hoard rules, which is in the Rivendell Region Guide. And it lets out like a treasure hoard rating. You can roll lots of tables to create treasure and money, and it lays out what they are. And, you know, I read that and I thought, this is quite interesting, but I found it a bit overcomplicated, and I wasn't like, oh, that's really fun. And I guess this comes on to, so in our game, essentially, I think one of the difficulties is that you want things to like have like a meaning and be impactful.
Yes.
And so quite early on, I think you found like a treasure hoard at the City of the Aethed. It was a difficult puzzle to get in. You had a difficult fight. So I wanted there to be a reward, and it was like a burial area. And there was ethical quandaries around that, but there was a lot of money. And you don't want it to be like, you know, like if I was rating it by the level you were at and the cost of stuff in the Adventure Middle Earth Player's Handbook, right? Be like, wow, one gold coin, a huge amount of money. Is that exciting? Whereas if you're like, you know, here's a huge pile of money, people are like, oh, that's maybe exciting. I don't know how you felt as a player there in that moment.
I think because certainly playing in the Vale of Anduin, it's hardly like there was any kind of commercial hub. It wasn't like there was this city that we knew had this shop which had magical items, and if we accumulated a certain amount of money, we could then go and buy, you know, a better sword. That's not really how it works. So just being like, here's a massive amount of money, it didn't feel there was anything to massively to spend that on. And really all money is a way of facilitating trade. And if there's nothing to trade for, then we don't really need the money. Yeah.
That's definitely the way I run the game. And I guess it depends on where you're playing and what your players are interested in. Some people might be really motivated by money. I don't think that we played a game that did that. And I think part of the reason for that was that we all found the monetary system really confusing. And I did sort of sometimes think like, what I'll do is I'll rewrite the equipment list. I'll change it to a decimal system, just standard, like 10 copper pieces of silver, 10 silvers of gold. And then I'll make sure I know what all the equipment costs would be that's fair. And there's quite an interesting list of equipment in the player's handbook. You know, I do quite like all the equipment that you can get. But to be honest, I never bothered prepping that because I just never felt like it was that needed. And occasionally it would come up and be like, I want to buy this. And I'd be like, okay. Eventually, I just got into the state of actually the resources. I think for ages, we haven't spoken about money. Like, I've not asked you for money for anything. And when it's come up as a reward, it's like, you know, and it's not really that. There's occasionally some of the characters didn't have as much money. And that created this, like, Halmir really struggled for money because he didn't have any. And that actually led to some quite interesting role playing moments where it was like, you know, he was put under pressure and stress and like interactions with dwarves and contracts and stuff. But what I ended up deciding, I think, maybe not consciously, was that the resources would be limited not by money, but by your time and your ability to get things done.
Yeah, I think it makes sense that you know, we don't need to count out all the pieces when we're staying in a particular place once you get to a certain kind of level, because it's like, well, you would be, you know, that's not an unreasonable thing to do, to spend a night at this inn. We don't necessarily need to go into the bank accounts to check how much you could do. I think what's helpful maybe with the tables in the book, even if you don't use the rules explicitly, is it does give you the relative value of things, which is what money's about. So you can see, like, actually this type of armor versus that type of armor, what's the monetary cost? So that if the players want to get it, and I'm thinking maybe the way Halmir can upgrade his armor is he'll do a small quest for someone in Dale, and the reward will be a suit of armor. You can think, right, well, actually, what's the relative cost of this thing against something else? Oh, this quest should be significantly harder, because actually that's a real improvement in armor. The book is telling me it's higher value, so I need to ask to do a bit more. And same with things like renting ponies, because that actually has mechanical benefits for exhaustion rules. It's like, okay, well, they want to rent a pony for this journey. What would the equivalent, what's the opportunity cost there? What's the equivalent sacrifice they could make? Because, you know, I don't know how much renting a pony for 2 weeks would be. How big a thing is that? Oh, I can look at this table and compare it to all these other things, what they've already got. You know, is this something they could afford? And I think that's a good way of doing it without ever needing to necessarily in game get into it.
There's a lot that you could buy and level up, although you never really look to do that. I'm just reading the rules again about Dwarven Forged weapons and armor and stuff, and actually they're really powerful in this game. But we kind of, I think, left it under roleplay when you got weapons.
Yes.
And I actually was probably quite generous with items and magical weapons or heirloom weapons, or, you know, there was things around that everybody ended up with. You know, basically people would be like, I'd like a new sword. And then I think I prefer to come up with a roleplay reason why you'd be given a sword. Yeah. Or find a sword, rather than, you know, I don't find it particularly interesting to buy stuff. Although there was one moment where I think someone bought a weapon, and anyway, I feel like most of the moments that involved money in our game, I look back on now and I'm like, like when we did try and use it, I never felt like it really fit the world that well.
Yeah,
and I think that's maybe coming back to what we were talking about, the lore and how, you know, it's always sort of jumped over.
So would it be safe to say that our advice is that if money and resource management and that detail is your thing, there are rules both in AIM and Lord of the Rings 5th edition to facilitate that. They are not necessarily very intuitive, so would advise all you and all the players to read them to understand the economy. But I think my advice would be, we found our game's tone and flavor is better once we set the economy aside. It felt more true to Middle-earth. Mm. And if you're in two minds about it, I think probably our advice would be, you can set it aside, you can do so successfully, and it's really benefited our game.
I wonder if it's also at lower levels, it's maybe more important. And then once you've, you know, we kind of got to a point where, like, okay, you've got lots of treasure, so money's no longer an object. Fine. I wonder if it would be easier, maybe talk about the Lord of the Rings role-playing game rules now, because just having not used those in game but read through them, I'm like, these are much more simple. And as we keep mentioning, we will go through the book and do a proper review at some point. We've made notes on most of that, but there's a lot in there, so it's taking a while to go through it. So in the equipment section on page 69 of the Lord of the Rings role-playing book, there is a section on coinage. The exchange rate, I wonder where they got this idea from, 10 copper piece coins equals a silver penny, to 10 silver pennies is a gold piece. Oh, that's nice and simple, isn't it? So, yeah, they have the same standard of living, but it's been simplified down to just frugal, common, and prosperous. It affects their starting gear, and then they have a thing called out-of-pocket expenses. So basically, whether someone can afford an out-of-pocket expense, they can say, you know, it comes down to their standard of living. So if you're a higher standard of living, you're more likely to be able to afford things. And it lays out stuff like the cost of stays at different inn types, different types of food, different types of drinks, different types of meal, different types of pipeweed. Costing makes a bit more sense. Like in Adventures of Middle-earth, a day's ration costs 120 copper pieces, which is 10 silver pieces, which is ludicrously expensive, I think.
A day's rations?
rations, one day, 120 copper pieces. Which is, and it's 12 copper pieces of silver pieces. That's 10 silver pieces. And for reference, a quiver of arrows is one. A robe is 10, is one, sorry. 50 feet of hempen rope is one. So I feel like there might be a typo there, because it doesn't really make sense to me that that would be so expensive. Or, you know, the conversion rate was different before and then they changed it. Either way, that's one of the notes on this that I've made, which is I've scored that out and changed it. Yeah. So strange. The but in the new rules, it sort of all ties together. It makes sense. You know, books are very expensive. Climber kits are very expensive. A bucket is very cheap. Bucket is surprisingly cheap. Bucket's only one copper piece. Anyway, don't lead into it too much. Why is chalk more expensive? The bucket economy. There's like role-playing games that you play sometimes where like the more like they have a bar system, like the more of something that's available and it gets cheaper.
Yeah.
So maybe it's like that. There's just the market's been flooded with buckets. I feel an adventure coming on.
I actually think there is, like, from a kind of money economic point of view, I think there's probably plenty of systems, and there could be entirely bespoke systems to play a game that's very grounded in trade and commerce and money and is kind of about that. And there are stories to tell in that realm. I just don't think this is the setting for it. I think it means that the way the rules have been written is kind of forcing something into the world that is not a big part of the world, and that it's kind of necessary to have the rules available to the players. But yeah, I wouldn't get hung up on them personally.
I think this game is so about the themes and the stories you want to tell. And I think that our party, which is driven by mainly personal goals a love of knowledge or, you know, loss and sorrow, is not that important. But I can envisage a party where this could be really important. And in those situations, I would recommend the newer rules. But for example, I think, like, one of the things I quite like the idea of is doing like an all dwarven company. And there, I think you could, you know, for example, just thinking of like spitballing some ideas about quests or storylines. If you had a group that motivation was to gain money, and that was very clear, like people wanting to gain wealth or have wealth in order to use it for something, that can then open up some interesting dynamics. It's like, okay, well, I'll put them in a situation where they could get money, but that would have a moral implication.
Yes, I like that.
Or like the money that they're gaining is ill-gotten from someone else. Is that the right thing to do? Or there's a potential effect on dragon sickness, or, you know, it's dangerous to get it. You know, do they prioritize safety or riches? And so actually the theme comes through, and, you know, it's a very deliberate part of the game. And then I think that would make more sense. But even in that game, I'm not sure the nitty-gritty bits of money and buying stuff would add that much. I don't know what you think there.
Even then, it feels like the layering on those narrative things and the kind of the moral quandaries and the potential are more interesting than just the numerical bit of it.
Unless you tied it into some way, like, you know, money used to be leveling, so maybe do that. I don't know. There's different ways of approaching it, but yeah, I think that's just our thoughts, and we're obviously not talking scholars, so there's a lot more written about it, and we did find some articles that went much more deeply into what scholars think Tolkien's thoughts were on, you know, his commentary on money and wealth in Middle-earth. So we haven't deep dived into that so much, but I guess, you know, there is a kind of tension between, you know, traditional role-playing games on which these games are based and in the Tolkien's world, and yes, and how you choose to implement that in your game really comes down to you and your players and what you enjoy. And if you're not enjoying it, then just bin it. That's what we did.
Yeah. Chuck your money in the bin. It'd be interesting to hear how other parties have played this. So if you have any suggestions, or if you want to say that we're talking rubbish and you've got a great economy in your game, then you can email us at thefellowshipphase@gmail.com. That's the one, at gmail.com, or tweet us at fellowshipphase. And yeah, let us know if we're talking nonsense and you've got a better idea. But it would be interesting to hear how money works in your game.
No emails except on party business. And comments, suggestions, and questions to thefellowshipphase@gmail.com. The long year turns to its close. Much we have accomplished these last seasons. Our fellowship disbands, but is not broken, and we will return.
On the next episode of The Fellowship Phase.
When can you buy things the cheapest in Lake Town?
I don't know, Callum. When?
When there's a fire sale.
Flawlessly delivered. Thank you.